Theykatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, listeners, to a deep dive into philosophy that is actually surprisingly relevant to your everyday decisions. Really practical stuff. We're unpacking one of the, well, foundational texts of Western thought today, a work that asks the big one, how do we build a genuinely good life?
That's right. Today, we are diving into the Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle. And like you said, this isn't some dusty abstract philosophy. It's a really comprehensive, systematic look at, you know, the fundamental question, how should human beings live? It's a huge work, honestly. But our mission today, let's keep it simple. We want to cut through the complexity. We want to show you how Aristotle defined true lasting happiness. And also why he was suspicious of goals we often chase today, like, say, wealth or fame.
Right. And what this ancient wisdom can maybe tell us about becoming, well, excellent people right now.
Exactly. And here's the perspective that I think makes this so vital, the real game changer. Aristotle argued that happiness, he called it eudaimonia, it isn't just a feeling, you know, not just a mood you hope to stumble into.
Okay.
It's more an objective state, a state of flourishing. And crucially, it's achieved only by developing excellent character.
So it shifts everything. Instead of just chasing good feelings, it's about actively building a meaningful life.
Precisely. Building it through your actions and character.
Okay, before we jump right into the ethics itself, maybe we should quickly set the stage. Talk about the author.
Good idea. We're talking about Aristotle. Lived 384 to 322 BCE. I mean, the man was a polymath. Wrote about everything.
Everything. Like what?
Poetry, logic, politics, physics, biology, even marine biology. And importantly, he spent 20 years, studying under Plato.
20 years. Wow. And then he later tutored Alexander the Great.
Yeah. Imagine that CV. Student of Plato. Tutor of Alexander. When you've got a mind that can analyze the cosmos and train the future conqueror of the known world.
You know you're dealing with a heavyweight thinker.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But what I find really fascinating, and you touched on this, is how different his method was from Plato's, despite being his star student.
Right. Plato was all about those abstract, perfect forms somewhere out there.
Exactly. Aristotle. He grounded his philosophy right here on Earth. Very empirical, very practical. His ethics came from carefully observing actual human behavior, real political systems. He looked at what works, you know, what makes people and societies function well.
So he studied what actually made successful people tick.
Pretty much. And that systematic approach, that's why he's often called the father of systematic ethical inquiry.
Yeah.
He wasn't just preaching. He was using logic, common sense, observation, treating ethics almost like a practical science.
A science of how to live well.
Kind of, yeah. He wanted a reliable method, a pathway to actually achieving goodness.
Okay, so let's walk that pathway. The Nicomachean Ethics. Named after his son, Nicomachus, right? Like leaks or notes.
That's the common understanding, yeah. Compiled from his lectures at the Lyceum. And it's not written for, like, monks in a cave. It's really a handbook for mature people. People already involved in life, maybe in politics or running a household, who want a rational way to think about being good.
A practical guide. And the core argument, you said, it addresses human motivation.
It really does. He starts by observing something pretty simple. Every single thing we do, every action, aims at some kind of good.
Like ordering coffee aims at getting caffeine.
Or enjoyment.
Right.
Or starting a business aims at profit, maybe innovation. And if you keep asking why for each goal, why do you want profit? For security, why security? To live comfortably, why live comfortably? Eventually, Aristotle says you hit a final goal, an ultimate purpose, the telos.
The end goal for the sake of which we do everything else.
Precisely. And for humans, he argues that telos can only be one thing. Eudaimonia.
Which we translate as flourishing, living well, being truly happy.
All of those capture part of it. It's the ultimate answer to why are you doing that? You do it ultimately to achieve eudaimonia. It's desired purely for its own sake. Nothing lies beyond it.
Okay, and this is where he kind of pushes back against common ideas of happiness.
Big time. He takes a hard look at things people often chase, wealth, pleasure, honor, fame, and says, nope, those can't be the ultimate goal.
Why not? They seem pretty popular.
Well, wealth, he says, is just instrumental. It's only good for what it can get you. It has no value in itself.
Okay, makes sense. What about pleasure?
Pleasure is too fleeting, too animalistic almost. We share the pursuit of pleasure with animals. It can't be the highest human good. And it's unstable.
And honor or fame?
That depends entirely on other people. What they think of you. It's fickle. You could lose it tomorrow. Eudaimonia, by contrast, is supposed to be stable because it comes from within you. It's an achievement.
An internal achievement. So how do we achieve it then?
By consistently acting according to reason. That's the key. And acting according to reason, done well, leads directly to cultivating virtues, excellences of character.
Virtues, like courage, honesty, generosity.
Those are the moral virtues, yes. The book then systematically explores how to build those, looks at intellectual virtues too, and really emphasizes the role of community, especially friendship.
Okay, let's dig into that structure. Book I lays the groundwork with this function argument, right?
Yes. It's a crucial piece. If the good life is flourishing, we need to ask, what is a human being's unique function? What are we for?
Like a good knife is for cutting well. A good eye is for seeing well.
Exactly. So what's the distinctive job of human being? What separates us from plants or animals?
Our ability to reason, to think, reflect.
That's Aristotle's conclusion. Rational activity. We don't just live and grow like plants or perceive and feel like animals. We use reason. Therefore, the human good, eudaimonia, must involve performing that unique function, rational activity, but performing it excellently.
Ah, so not just reasoning, but reasoning well.
Reasoning well. Acting according to that reason, consistently, in accordance with virtue. And importantly, over a complete life. It's not about having one great virtuous moment.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. A lifetime project of being the best human you can be.
You got it. Performing your humanity at its peak.
Okay, so if excellence is key, how do we actually get excellent? Book two tackles this, right? With habit.
Yes. Book two is huge for practical application. This is where he makes a key distinction. Intellectual virtues like scientific knowledge or wisdom, you can learn through teaching, reading, studying.
Okay.
But moral virtues, courage, temperance, justice, those you learn through doing, through practice, through habituation.
This feels really important. So you're not just born brave or fair.
Nope. According to Aristotle, we have the potential for virtue, but we actualize it through habit. Ethos, the Greek word for habit or custom, is where we get the word ethics.
Ah, the connection's right there.
Right. You become just by repeatedly performing just actions. You become courageous by performing courageous actions, especially when it's hard. You do it again and again.
Until it becomes part of your character, like second nature.
Exactly that. It becomes a stable disposition. That's why this is so much about character formation, not just following a list of rules.
Which leads us straight into probably his most famous idea, the doctrine of the mean.
The golden mean, yeah. It's his practical tool for navigating our actions and emotions, since we can easily go wrong, either too much or too little. Moral virtue, he says, is the mean or the intermediate state between two extremes. These extremes are vices, one of excess, one of deficiency.
Can you give us that classic example, courage?
Perfect example, facing danger. The virtue is courage. The deficiency, the too little, is cowardice. You run away or freeze up. The excess, the too much, is recklessness or rashness. You charge in blindly without assessing the risk.
So courage is finding that sweet spot in the middle.
The appropriate response, yeah. Or think about giving money. Too little. Stinginess. Too much. Giving indiscriminately. Wastefulness or prodigality. The mean is generosity.
But hang on, you said it's not just simple math, right? The mean isn't always dead center.
Crucial point. It's relative. Relative to us as individuals. And relative to the specific circumstances.
What do you mean?
Well, what counts as courageous for a trained firefighter entering a burning building is totally different from what's courageous for a child facing a bully. The mean response depends on who you are and what the situation demands.
So it requires judgment, a lot of judgment.
Tremendous judgment, which is why he says that famous line, anyone can become angry, that is easy.
But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, this is not easy.
Exactly. Finding the mean requires this precise calibration. It's about channeling emotions appropriately, not just suppressing them.
Okay, so if finding the mean requires all this judgment, how do we get good at that? This brings us to another key idea, doesn't it? Practical wisdom.
Yes, phronesis. This is the crucial intellectual virtue that works hand in hand with the moral virtues. He discusses it mainly in Book 6.
So what exactly is phronesis?
It's the ability, the intellectual capacity to perceive what is the right thing to do, to find that mean in a specific concrete situation. It connects the general principle to the particular case.
It bridges the gap between knowing what's good in theory and actually doing the right thing here and now.
Perfectly put. You might know, generally, that honesty is good. But phronesis helps you figure out how to be honest in this tricky situation without being needlessly cruel, for example. It's the skill of ethical perception and deliberation in context.
Can you give maybe a leadership example? How would a manager use phronesis?
Okay, sure. Imagine a manager has an employee who's usually a top performer but suddenly misses a huge deadline. Turns out they're going through a serious family crisis.
Right.
Now, a manager just following the rule book might automatically issue a formal warning. Policy is policy.
Right.
But a manager exercising phronesis looks at the whole picture. They consider the employee's track record, the severity of the personal issue, the impact on the team, the need for fairness, and the goal of maintaining long-term excellence. They deliberate and discern the mean response in this unique context. Maybe it's offering support, adjusting workload temporarily, having a compassionate conversation, something tailored that upholds standards but also accounts for the human reality. They ask, what would a person of sound judgment do right here?
That makes so much sense. It's about flexible, wise application, not rigid rule following.
Exactly. And Aristotle is clear. You can't be truly virtuous without phronesis.
Yeah.
You can't have phronesis without being morally virtuous. They develop together.
Okay, that's fascinating. And he also emphasizes we don't do this alone, right? Which brings us to friendship, books 8 and 9.
Absolutely essential. He dedicates 2 whole books to philia, or friendship. He says it's most necessary for life.
More than just nice to have.
Much more. He says, quite bluntly, without friends, no one would choose to live, though we had all other goods. Think about that. Even if you had everything else, life wouldn't be worth living without friends.
Wow, that's a strong statement. And he breaks down different types of friendship.
Yes, 3 main types based on what holds the friendship together. Utility, pleasure, and virtue.
Okay, utility and pleasure seem straightforward.
Yeah, utility friendships are based on mutual usefulness. Your business contacts, maybe someone you carpool with. It lasts as long as the utility lasts. Pleasure friendships are based on shared fun and enjoyment. People you go partying with, your tennis partner. Also, often temporary, when the shared activity stops, the friendship might fade.
Right, those feel very common. What about the third type?
Virtue friendship. This is the highest, most stable, and rarest form. It's based on mutual recognition and admiration of each other's good character.
So you love your friend not just because they're useful or fun, but because they are a genuinely good person.
Exactly. You wish good things for them for their own sake. And this is where he talks about a true friend being like a second self.
A second self? How so?
A true friend helps you see yourself more clearly, including your flaws. They support your growth and virtue, hold you accountable. It's a relationship that actively helps both people become better humans.
That's a very high bar for friendship.
It is, but it shows how central relationships are to achieving that full human flourishing eudaimonia.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. Let's maybe try to pull out some of the biggest, most impactful themes from all this.
Sounds good. Theme 1 definitely is this radical redefinition of happiness as flourishing.
We keep coming back to it, but it's so important. Eudaimonia isn't a feeling you chase.
No. It's an objective state reflecting how well you're living up to your potential as a human being, how excellently you're performing your function. It really challenges our modern focus on just feeling good, seeking pleasure, or avoiding pain.
So the reflection for us is focus less on managing moment-to-moment moods and more on the quality of our actions and character.
That's the idea. The deep, stable joy associated with eudaimonia is seen as a result of living virtuously, not the goal itself.
Okay. Theme 2.
Character is a skill. This one is incredibly empowering, I think.
How so?
Because Aristotle basically says ethics is practical. Being good is something you learn through practice, like learning piano or a sport. It's not mystical. It's about deliberate habit formation.
So the responsibility is on us through our daily choices, our repeated actions.
Entirely. Which is great news, really. That means change is possible. You don't need some massive willpower explosion. You need consistent small efforts to practice the virtues, to aim for the mean, build those moral muscles day by day.
Focus on habits, not just heroic acts. I like that. And theme 3.
The unity of virtue and reason. You can't really separate being a good person from being a smart, discerning person, at least in the practical sense.
Meaning good intentions aren't enough.
They're not enough. To act well, especially in complex situations, you need that intellectual sharpness, that phronesis, to figure out what the right thing to do actually is.
Hmm.
Effective ethical action requires a thinking mind.
Which highlights why deliberation, reflection, and maybe even seeking wise counsel are actually part of being moral.
Precisely. It's not just about having a good heart. It's about using your head, too.
The ethics is also just packed with memorable lines, isn't it? Real condensed wisdom.
Oh, absolutely. Little nuggets that stick with you.
Let's share a few. Maybe start with a core definition.
Okay. Happiness is an activity of soul in accordance with perfect virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Straightforward, right? Happiness is doing, acting virtuously. It's active, not passive. It requires effort.
And my personal favorite, the one about habit. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit.
That sums up the character formation piece so well. Your character is the sum total of your habits, your repeated choices.
Then there's the one about anger, showing the complexity of the mean. Anyone can become angry, that is easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time.
For the right purpose and in the right way, this is not easy. It just perfectly captures that virtue isn't about bland neutrality. It's about precisely targeted and appropriate emotional response. Requires real skill.
And finally, the one emphasizing the social aspect. Without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods.
A powerful reminder that we're social creatures. Flourishing isn't a solo project. Relationships, especially deep ones, are necessities, not optional extras.
Okay, let's bring this home. How can we actually use these ideas, like, tomorrow? Real-life applications.
We'll take the doctrine of the mean. You can actively use it for self-assessment. Think about a recent situation where things went wrong. Ask yourself, was I closer to the deficiency or the excess?
Like in that difficult meeting, was I too passive, cowardice, deficiency, or maybe too aggressive, recklessness, excess?
Exactly. And the goal isn't just analysis. It's to identify a concrete practice. Okay, next time, I will aim for the mean by doing X. Maybe speaking up once clearly or pausing before reacting.
And professionally, especially in leadership, phronesis seems key.
Hugely. Instead of relying only on rigid rules or policies, a leader using phronesis assesses the unique context of every significant issue, a performance problem, a crisis, an ethical dilemma. They ask, what does wise judgment require here? It encourages more nuanced, situation-specific solutions.
What about in relationships?
Apply the friendship analysis. Look at your important relationships. Are they mostly based on utility or pleasure? Are you consciously investing in those virtue friendships? It might prompt you to intentionally deepen certain connections, moving them beyond just convenience towards that mutual moral support Aristotle valued so highly.
And I can see the habituation idea being huge for parenting or teaching.
Definitely. If virtue is built through practice, then parents and educators have a crucial role in creating environments where kids consistently practice positive behaviors. Not just talking about honesty, but creating situations where honesty is practiced and reinforced until it becomes ingrained.
Building those habits early.
Exactly.
So as we wrap up, what was maybe the most surprising thing for you revisiting the ethics for this discussion?
You know, it might be that final point Aristotle makes about the hierarchy of flourishing. We spend almost the whole book focused on moral virtue, courage, justice, friendship, practical wisdom, the life of action in the community.
Right, the life of a good citizen.
But then right at the end, in Book X, he argues that the highest form of eudaimonia, the most complete happiness, is actually the life of contemplation, the life of the philosopher, devoted to understanding eternal truths through theoretical reason.
That is surprising, after all that focus on practical action.
It is. He sees contemplation as the most divine activity humans can engage in, using the best part of ourselves, our intellect, to connect with the highest objects of knowledge. It champions the pursuit of wisdom purely for its own sake.
A challenging thought in our very action-oriented world. So, a final synthesis, what's the lasting value here?
I think the ethics offers this fundamental paradigm shift, away from just following external rules or just chasing feelings, towards an ethics of personal excellence and character building. The core message, the thing to really chew on, is that the good life isn't something you just find or receive passively. It's something you actively construct day by day through your choices and habits. It encourages us to constantly ask, what kind of person am I becoming? What kind of person do I want to become? And to realize that striving for our own individual excellence actually contributes to the good of the whole community. It's a deeply challenging, but ultimately optimistic vision of human potential.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.